We all want to feel like our lives are important. We live in important times. You know, you don't want to think that you're just a little blip along the way and the world's going to, the party's going to go on without you for another million, 100 million years. You don't want to hear that. You don't want to think that. You want to think, I'm going to be the generation, the last generation that sees the end. You know, I think it empowers people a little bit, makes them feel better about what might be interpreted as insignificance. You know, I wouldn't say that, but that might be the fear that they're feeling.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this week's episode, what is good thinking? How does one do it? Are skeptics arrogant? And is there a point to debate? We'll find out. All coming up next. Hello and welcome to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett. I'm your host for this week's episode. We're going to be talking with Guy P. Harrison about his new book, Good Thinking, and what good thinking is and what it's all about and how you, too, can be engaged in good thinking. Then, Peggy Knutson interviews Dr. Jeff Jarman about debating. Is it possible to win a debate? Well, hang around and we'll find out. But first, here's my interview with Guy Harrison. And I have the pleasure, once again, of speaking with Guy P. Harrison. How are you, Guy?
I'm great, Bo. Nice to be back with you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, did you know that you were my first person I interviewed here on the Humanist Hour?
Was I really?
Yes, you were.
Wow. Didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
I was thinking, who do I want for the first show? And I said, it's got to be Guy. I got to get
Guy. Well, let's hope I'm not the last, okay? Let's hope this keeps going. You're doing a good job. Let's keep it going.
Let's hope. All right. Well, today we're going to be talking about your newest book called Good Thinking, What You Need to Know to Be Smarter, Safer, Wealthier, and Wiser. When did you come out with this book?
Yeah, it's just out this week. It's brand new. Yeah, Good Thinking. What it is, it's a sort of a gathering together of all the things I feel are really important that everybody needs to know about when it comes to good thinking, how you can be a more rational person, avoid the common mistakes that everyone makes. Doesn't matter how smart you are, how educated you are, how brilliant you may be, you are still a human with a human brain, and you are going to stumble over and over throughout life. So I've tried to take it all and get it all together and pack it into one book, good information about how the human brain evolved, how it's put together, how it works, all these weird, quirky, mysterious, unexpected things that our mind does in daily life that if you're not aware of, you are just going to make mistake after mistake through life. And we're all going to make mistakes, but you can reduce that error rate tremendously. You can be much more safer, efficient, and productive throughout life if you're a good thinker.
I wanted to focus on those two words for a moment. We often heard about learning and thinking better and critical thinking and how it could help you be smarter and wiser, but safer and wealthier, those are two terms that you don't usually hear associated with critical thinking. So you want to talk about those for a moment?
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, this is not a get-rich-quick book, not by any means. I even point that out in the introduction. I say if you're tuning in here hoping to, find out how to make $1 million in a week or something, you got the wrong guy, okay? I'm usually the guy criticizing those kind of books.
Right.
What I mean when I say wealthier is I'm talking about efficiency in life. That's part of efficiency in life, not wasting money, not making bad investments, whether it's, buying the wrong book on the shelf in Barnes & Noble or investing your life savings in some get-rich-quick scheme or even worse, just throwing it all away on total nonsense, like just taking the wrong career path because you're simply not applying good thinking. There's so many things we can avoid when it comes to wasting money. And as far as safer, my gosh, I've traveled all over the world. I've traveled through 6 continents and I have seen horrible things. I mean, horrible things. People, literally suffering and dying for lack of good thinking because they bought something, trusted something, believed in something when they shouldn't have. And if they had been better critical thinkers, they would have said no and walked away, but they didn't. So they bought into some quack cure. They neglected medical science. That's just one example. They followed the wrong leader. Look at ISIS, this problem with the Islamic State going on in the Middle East that's getting all the headlines recently, everybody talks about, it's a problem of Islam, it's a problem of psychos or young men seeking thrills, it's a little bit of all that, but it's really that's all a distant second to the real problem, which is bad thinking, sloppy thinking. You've got people following leaders who are spouting pure nonsense, talking about, you know, a magical end of the world that's going to happen real soon, and they have no evidence for it. It's totally illogical, and yet people buy into it. If they were good thinkers, these ISIS recruits, you know, they wouldn't cross the street on the word of these people who are saying, you know, the world's 10,000 years old and it's going to end supernaturally within a couple of years. They wouldn't get out of bed on the word of these people if they were thinking clearly, much less travel around the world and join their army. I mean, it's crazy. You know, good thinking keeps us safe.
Yeah. And good thinking has a lot to do with our physical activity too, doesn't it? The fact that our mind and our brains are connected. Our minds are a function of our brains. If we don't take care of our brains, which is part of our physical body, then we don't take care of our minds, essentially.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's amazing because, you know, 2,500 years ago, Socrates was pushing this concept of mind and body, strong mind, strong body. And man, science has proven him true. It's unbelievable. and just in recent years, more and more and more keeps coming out about how important physical activity is to the brain. I mean, you can literally grow your brain by doing exercise, aerobic activity, moving, sweating, getting out there and doing stuff. And you don't have to run triathlons or, you know, compete in marathons and all that kind of stuff. It doesn't have to be that intense. Just 30 minutes a day of somewhat vigorous activity, walking fast, you know, swimming, cycling, that kind of stuff. And consistency over the years, it really helps. And it increases circulation in your brain. It actually encourages, sets forth this process where you grow more neurons. That was a big misunderstanding. Mm. Only, you know, in the recent decade or so, scientists have discovered that throughout life, we can grow more neurons. It used to, you know, you would read in books just 20, 30 years ago that you were born with a finite number of brain neurons. These are the brain cells, you know, that's what thinking's dependent upon, neurons. And you're born with this specific amount and that's it. That's all you got for life. And then you just start losing them as you age. Well, now we know, hey, wait a minute. You can actually build up a cognitive reserve in your youth, you know, in your 20s, 30s, 40s. You can be adding to your number. So when you hit your 50s, 60s, 70s, you've got more in the bank. Mm. And it's amazing stuff. Like in the book, I cite a couple of examples where, just one real quick one. They, some researchers did an autopsy on a nun who was very old. She died, and they were shocked because her brain was just ravaged by Alzheimer's disease. And yet nobody even knew she had it while she was alive because she had built up sufficient cognitive reserve that her brain just worked around this attack that it was under inside, that she was still able to function, be smart, alert, memory working fine, right up to death, even though she was battling with Alzheimer's. It's amazing. You know, it's just like money in the bank. You know, the more you've got in your savings account, the better you can withstand it when your house gets flooded or, you know, a hurricane hits. You can handle paying for that new roof or whatever, you know, or relocating. You're in a better position to deal with a disaster. Same thing with the brain. That's why it's so important to eat well and stay physically active consistently. And by the way, by eat well, in the book, I get into a lot of details about that, but I'll tell you real quick, it's nothing magical. It's nothing ultra complicated. I mean, it's leafy green vegetables. It's high quality protein like salmon. It's a balanced, sensible diet. That's really what it is. And avoiding things like added sugar, high rates of that, that's devastating to the brain.
Yeah, it sure is. Well, I think that this is one of the most interesting concepts that I didn't realize until later on in life. You know, when you hear stories that your brain starts to decay over time, which it does in a way, but what people don't realize is, yeah, your ability to recall memories slows down as you age. And when I talk as you age, when you get in your 50s, 60s, 70s, but people aren't always acting at their peak early on in life. So you can still improve your memory and improve your brain, and you could be better at age 60 and 70 than you were at age 20, assuming that you weren't at your peak at age 20. Because people don't always exercise their mind like they should be. And it's the same thing with your physical. I know this isn't really what we're talking about, but it is an important concept when we're talking about our physical bodies and our health. Most people don't go through their teens and 20s and 30s in peak physical shape. So what that means is when you're our age, when you're 40s, 50s, or even 60s, you can be in the best shape of your life just because you were in crappy shape early on. So you don't have to go through with that mindset that things always get worse, because they don't have to get worse. Although the odds may be against you a little bit, the more you age, you could still beat those odds just by doing the best you can for both your brain and your body.
Very good point. Very good point. There are some exercises, just to support you, your example. There are some exercises I do in the gym with weight training that I am much stronger now than I was when I was in college. And I was fit in college. I worked out and stuff. But just over the years, I have gotten stronger in certain exercises, much stronger than I was in my 20s. Yeah. And now I'm early 50s. I mean, it's amazing. You know, if you're consistent, you work smart, you keep stressing the body in positive ways, let it recover, give it what it needs to rebuild. I mean, it just works fine for you. It really does. You know, another really important point to add, Bo, we mentioned earlier about the importance of lifelong learning for stimulating the brain, keeping it healthy, keeping those neurons working and growing and all that. Well, I just want to add to that. I don't want to just give people the idea I'm pushing brain games and things like that, you know, like crossword puzzles and all. Those are great. Those are good things. I mean, not knocking them at all. But I would steer away from, my advice to people is don't rely on, you know, little internet games you find and stuff like that. By lifelong learning, what I really push and what the science is loudest on right now, most supportive of the evidence right now, is learning new skills, you know, doing something totally new. Like for the first time in your life, go try to learn French when you're 50. Hmm. You know, for the first time in your life when you're 45, learn to juggle, you know, or take up a new sport. Play volleyball. Go play beach volleyball for the first time ever when you're 50 years old. Just give it a try. You know, don't go crazy. Don't hurt yourself. But when you try new things, try new skills, try to learn computer programming when you're 40, you know, it's never too late to learn new things. And the action of doing that, of putting that challenge in your brain, it's just so healthy. It's incredibly healthy, and it really pushes back. It defends you against Alzheimer's disease, dementia, all these things that hit so many, just an astonishingly high number of elderly people are hit with this stuff. And you can eliminate it, delay it, hold it off, reduce the impact of it, all these things, by just learning new stuff. And when I say learn new stuff, don't think I'm talking about some agonizing chore you've got to do, you know, pick out some burden, some form of torture to go to. You know, it's a big world out there. It's a big universe. Figure out something that attracts you. You know, get into astronomy and learn all about telescopes or something. But find something that is exciting to you and then run with it and learn a whole new thing. Turn yourself into an expert in something brand new. You'll have fun along the way, and you're going to get so much more good quality mileage out of your brain.
Hmm. You're here. Critical thinking, and especially the word skepticism, is often associated with atheism. How do you get around this when selling this idea to Christians? Welcome back. My name is Bo Bennett, and I'm speaking with Guy P. Harrison, talking about his new book, Good Thinking.
Well, I've written two previous books that directly address religious claims and all that. So I'm, you know, I don't shy away from religion at all. And this book, Good Thinking, actually has a small part in there about religion, how to deal with that. Because I know very well from talking to people all over the world from numerous different belief systems, how difficult it is to get them to buy into this whole critical thinking, skepticism thing, because like you said, that's the first thing they think of. Wait a minute, this guy is challenging my belief in my God or gods. That ain't gonna happen. We're not going there. Forget it. Hmm. Shut down. Game over. And so the way I approach it is this. I tell people, hey, look, if your religion is so important to you and it means so much to you, okay, fine. But guess what? Then fine, we won't go there. But guess what? You still need to be a critical thinker to some degree anyway. You need to be a skeptic, because the most religious person on the earth still doesn't want to be a sucker and get robbed for all their money by every con artist who comes along. You know, a devout Christian in America doesn't willingly, knowingly want to give their money to some, you know, con artist faith healer on TV who's begging them for money. They don't want to be idiots. Okay. They don't. I've interviewed many of these people. I've talked to them. I know them. They think they have bought in and they believe the lie, but they don't want to be stupid. So if you can get them to buy in even a little bit to the whole skeptical, critical thinking thing and get them to challenge claims, you're winning. You're helping them because, you know, you start out with alternative medicine, maybe. Maybe they'll start questioning things in that area. Maybe paranormal claims, you know, Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, with that. And then it becomes a process. It's up to them. You can't think for someone. All you can do is encourage them and show them some skills and try to lead by example, maybe, and that's it. Ultimately, it's up to them. But I've seen this happen many times, and trust me, it's better to be a little skeptical than not hardly skeptical at all. It's better to be a fair or pretty average or mediocre critical thinker than it is to be a weak critical thinker. Something's better than nothing. So I always tell people that. And also I tell them, I say, hey, look, I understand your sensitivity about the whole religion thing, but guess what? Look, for example, here in America, Christians, any Christian with half a brain is going to admit there is all sorts of fraud and lying and deceit going on within organized religion. They say it themselves all the time. Be careful of false prophets and all. They're saying it. So I say, yeah, you're right. I agree. Let's watch out for them. And here's how you watch out for them. And then I explain to them steps, you know, questioning everything, asking for evidence, how to think like a scientist, how to do research, all these things, how to revise when necessary because you got better evidence, how to change your mind, why that's so important to change your mind when necessary according to new evidence, all these things. When you get them going in that direction, you've done them a good deed. You know, so what if you don't convert somebody in 10 minutes to reality and reason? I mean, that's not going to happen that often, okay? But man, if you plant the seed of good thinking in their mind and you walk away, you never see that person again, you've done a good deed. You've made the world a little better because that seed might grow. In many cases, it does.
Absolutely. And you probably found this as well. I run into a lot of people who have these sacred cows. And when I give speeches such as what we're talking about, the content we're talking about, like just recently I gave a speech titled Psychology of Woo, talking about all this stuff and how we believe in this stuff and why we believe in this stuff, why our brains fool us and trick us. And people are usually with me. They're with me, but they're with me 95%. And everybody has like this different sacred cow. So for example, they'll come up to me, hey, Bo, I loved everything you talked about, except that part when you talked about vaccines not causing autism. Now, that's not woo. I don't know how you could possibly relate that to, let's say, UFOs or L. Ron Hubbard. And it's not just that, though. But you will have the people, the UFO believers, who will say, yeah, all that stuff, the vaccines, I totally am with you on that, and that's woo. But, whoa, when you're talking about UFOs, that's something completely different. Everybody has their own sacred cow. And I find it challenging to get them to see that their sacred cow is just as faulty as all these other ones, using the same method of thinking, just because it's so protected. How do you handle situations like this?
Yeah. Well, you know so much about this. I mean, you're an expert on this stuff. You know the backfire effect. Sometimes I don't even hit people head on with their pet belief, their pet irrational belief. Like I found this to be very effective because a lot of people say you've got a guy who is a devout believer in Bigfoot. He just knows Bigfoot is out there and he ain't budging. All right. Now you can bang your head against him and go at it for, you know, debate after debate, whatever. And you're probably not going to get anywhere because he's just going to dig his heels in deeper. The more evidence you throw at him, the more logic you come with, the more, you know, the more you demand evidence for him, he's just going to dig in. He's emotionally invested. He ain't budging. You're wasting your time. So you go at him a different way. You try to do a flanking maneuver. You say, hey, well, let's talk about the Loch Ness Monster. What's up with that? You know, and you attack that and you go after that and you question it and you show all the problems and the photos and the analysis, the mistakes, the hoaxes. You go on and on, the lack of a body, all this stuff, without ever touching on directly on his pet belief. And that's a way to get around that, because you got to be careful. I'm telling you, I avoid it. I as I've matured over the years, I think I've become more effective when interacting with people by not really falling into debates with them about what they believe in, because it just doesn't work. People just want to argue. It ends up being two lawyers going at it, and the truth and reality ends up being irrelevant. It's just who's going to win the argument. Right. And that bores me. It's not productive, you know. And plus, it's not always positive, you know. And I'm like an optimistic, upbeat kind of guy. I don't want to go around arguing with people and trying to win debates. You know, that doesn't turn me on. I like talking with people, helping them. In fact, one of the things I always do, I state this with people. I say, hey, first of all, listen, you and I are not having some battle here, okay? Whether or not people are being abducted by aliens, we're not fighting over this. What we're doing, you and I are on the same side. We're over here side by side together looking at this question, and we're trying to get at what's true and what's real. So we're in this together. We're on the same team, right? You know, that's the approach I take. And I found that to be pretty productive, you know, because even if people don't walk away going, wow, you're right, alien abductions is silly, there's no reason to believe in that. Even if they don't walk away doing that, they walk away feeling, you know, positive about the encounter. They don't hate me. And they're more likely to actually think about it in meaningful ways later, you know. And I think that's the best way to do this. Yeah. That's the way to do effective, campaigning for good thinking.
Yeah.
You've got to understand how weird the human brain is, the way the mind works, the way we perceive reality, memory, vision. It's not the way everybody thinks. And I cite studies in here, you know, studies have been done in the general public, surveys. People have no idea out there how memory really works, how unreliable it is, how it's constructive. It's like this story in your head, it's like this Hollywood film of the past, okay? And it's edited, it's embellished, it's reenacted. It ain't a CNN video from the news event, you know, it's not. And people don't know that. And they think when you look at something with your eyes, when you look out at your, you know, your neighborhood with your eyes, they think you're seeing reality. Well, not really. Not you're seeing a reflection of reality, a presentation of reality that your brain is serving up to you. And it's done in the name of efficiency. It works well 99.9% of the time, but it can lead us astray whenever weird things happen or strange things happen or our emotions or beliefs get the best of us and lead us into thinking we're seeing something that's really not there. It's not what we think it is. You know, a cloud is really just a cloud. It's not a spaceship. And so if, like you said, the more you understand about these things, the less likely you are to be hoodwinked by your own brain. That's so important. You know, I was being interviewed on a show that's sort of like pro ghost belief, you know, it's like a paranormal type radio show. And they were interviewing me and the host asked me, like, well, what would it take to convince you that ghosts are real? What if you saw one in your bedroom at night, you know? And I thought about it. And I said, wow, you know, it might scare the hell out of me. I might climb under my bed and be terrified if it looks real and all that. But the next morning, I'm going to think it through. I'm not going to suddenly become a lifelong believer in ghosts because I know what the human brain is capable of. It's so well documented. We can see anything, things that aren't there. We can see it all. It's all just, you know, pops up. I once did like a vision quest thing, you know, not too weird, but I was on a deserted island in the Caribbean for a few days just by myself. And I heard my name shouted one night. It was amazing. Nobody was on this island. It's a very small, deserted island. I heard it just as clear as could be, and it freaked me out. I was actually scared that somebody was on the island. I went all around just to make sure. You know, I did a lap of the island. Nobody was there, but it was so convincing. But yet, clearly, I thought it through, and I said, now what's more likely, that, you know, some ghost shouted my name out in the middle of the Caribbean here and then left, or that it was like an audio hallucination, you know? It was just a thing my brain conjured up, probably because of the loneliness I was experiencing, you know? That's more likely. Now, I don't know. Maybe it was a ghost. Maybe a ghost did really come to that island that night and yell, "Guy," and then fly away. Maybe that happened. I'm open-minded. But in my mind, what's more likely is that it was just one, you know, the quirky human brain doing what it does. It just served up this weird little misfire and I heard "Guy," you know, that's how the brain is. You got to understand that stuff to be I won't say a rational human, but to be a more rational human, you've got to understand at least the basics of this stuff.
Yeah. So does anybody ever call you arrogant by being overly skeptical?
Yeah, I've been accused of that. And it's funny because, you know, these are people who haven't really read my books, because one of the consistent themes in all my books is that if you are an arrogant skeptic, it means you ain't doing it right, okay? Because part of being a good skeptic, a good thinker, is humility. You have to be humble because, my gosh, you are, you know, your brain, your conscious mind is such a minority bit player in this bizarre universe inside your cranium that's going on. You've got to be humble because, man, you are capable of believing anything, buying into anything. Okay, we all are. So you got to be careful. You got to always second guess yourself. You know, you show me a person who calls themselves a skeptic and is 100% confident that they can never be in error and they would never buy some nonsense in a shopping mall or something like that, then I will show you a fool, because you have got to be humble. You've always got to reconsider your moves. You got to think before you leap. You got to reconsider everything. That's a big part of being a good thinker. I tell you though, one thing, Bo, I have over the years modified my language a lot in reaction to that accusation, you know, because in fact, probably too much. So I try to err on the side of being very gentle and very polite. In fact, my two books on religion, 50 Simple Questions for Every Christian and 50 Reasons People Give for Believing in a God, those two books, one of the things they're sort of acclaimed for is that my tone is very respectful and calm. I'm not attacking and all, because I'm really trying to avoid that, because all that does, in fact, I get into that in Good Thinking in a general sense, that one of the ways to actually make a peaceful dialogue, productive dialogue with irrational believers is to make sure you don't turn them off by, you know, because remember, you're not just talking, when you're talking to an irrational believer, you're not just talking to that conscious person, you're talking to that subconscious person as well. And if they don't like your attitude, your tone, man, you are shut down. Nothing you say is really going to sink in. So you've got to be as nice and as little of a threat in appearance to them as possible. You got to be friendly if you really want to get through that little narrow gate to their mind.
Yeah, it's a good point. So let's move on to the whole idea of conspiracy theories. How does what we're talking about so far kind of lead into this, and why are conspiracy theories just so popular today?
Well, because there's 7 billion people on the planet, and conspiratorial thinking is part of being human. It really is. There's some great research, and I get into this in Good Thinking, some great research out there now which ties or attempts to tie conspiracy theory belief to gossip, you know, gossip, which has been around with us forever, you know, probably, you know, when the first few Homo erectus, you know, band members sat around the first campfire, probably one of the first things they did was talk about the guy who was still out in the forest and wasn't back yet. They probably said bad things about him or something. Gossip has been around with us forever because it's a social glue. It's a way of communicating important information to warn people in a story form, kind of. And so it's very effective. You know, you say, hey, watch out for that neighbor over there. He looks a little weird. You know, you better watch out, you know, and tell Mabel, your wife, you know, hey, watch out for that guy. I saw him the other day and he was shaving his cat or something. So be careful. You know, gossip is this way that we spread information. It's in the form of enticing stories that are also warnings. You know, when you hear about 9/11 truthers, you know, the World Trade Center brought down by George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, when you hear those stories, that there's something deeper there. It's a warning. It's saying, hey, listen to this story because I'm trying to warn you about government, evil people in powerful positions. We've got to be careful, you know? And so that's why they're so popular. But the thing is, the thing about conspiracy theories, you got to be careful because, again, it's not about intelligence. There's a tendency for people to dismiss conspiracy theories as just, you know, silly people, you know, dumb people just believe in anything. But not at all. You know, very intelligent people believe some really wild ideas. You know, the moon hoax, Apollo astronauts never walked on the moon. You know, believe me, there's some sensible, educated, intelligent people who believe that nonsense claim. They really do. So you got to be on guard against that stuff. And it's fascinating. I mean, in the book I get into, you know, people who believe that Osama bin Laden was already dead. This, just to show you how weird conspiracy belief is. People who believe that Osama bin Laden was already dead when the SEALs raided that compound in Pakistan, they think it was all just a big show to make Obama look good or something like that. the people who believe he was already dead are also, when questioned on a separate occasion, they are much more likely to believe that Osama bin Laden is still alive, that the government lied. He's really out there still, that they didn't kill him. And so, you know, it's complete contradiction. How can you agree to both of those things, you know?
Right.
But they are, because there's a deeper thing. It's a mistrust of government or some politician or something. And so it's fascinating to study these things because they really do measure something going on in society, you know, about what we're not trusting, you know, like the vaccine thing, you know, to actually think that these scientists and medical researchers would just put poison out there to harm children, you know, and they know it, they actually know it, and they're doing it anyway so they can get rich. I mean, that's a horrifying thing, you know, and it really gets your attention, especially as a parent. But you got to measure that, and something, I think there's something in there, maybe a fear of science in general. It's kind of getting away from a lot of people. If you think about it, science education is so poor now in schools, in America, in wealthy countries, that it's almost like magic to many people, and they fear it in an irrational way. And not that we shouldn't fear it in some ways, but they fear it in an irrational way that can lead to just all sorts of crazy beliefs.
Yeah. Well, you know what today is, Guy? Today is October 7th, and according to many, many posts on Facebook, it's the last day of the world. Did you know that?
Oh, again, I didn't even know that one. See that? Another doomsday passed me by. I didn't even know. I wasn't even prepared for this one. Wow. Well, who's promoting this one? I've
some Christian minister. It apparently there's a biblical reference or something that supports this idea. Yeah, believe it or not.
See how busy I've been lately. Usually I'm on top of these. I'm all over these things. But yeah, I've just missed this one. Yeah, I've been very much into these apocalypse, you know, these prophecies of the end of the world for a long time. They really fascinate me. You know, they just happen over and over and over again. People never learn. It's incredible. You know, no evidence, no logic, but let's believe it anyway. You know, I think it's a way to maybe gain a little control. Your outlook of the universe, you know, there's going to be a, you know, if you believe there's this finite specific beginning to the earth, there's going to be this fine perfect ending as well, and it just feels symmetrical. And plus, we all want to feel like our lives are important. We live in important times. Hmm. You know, you don't want to think that you're just a little blip along the way, and the world's going to, the party's going to go on without you for another million, you know, 100 million years. You don't want to hear that. You don't want to think that. You want to think, I'm going to be the generation, the last generation that sees the end. You know, I think it empowers people a little bit, makes them feel better about what might be interpreted as insignificance. You know, I wouldn't say that, but that might be the fear that they're feeling.
You're listening to The Humanist Hour. This is Bo Bennett, and we're back speaking with Guy P. Harrison about his book, Good Thinking.
You know, but it's fascinating. But you know what? There's a whole other subject, a whole other side to this subject, and that's, you know, end of the world. There's a whole science to it. There really are evidence-based possibilities for the end of the world, the end of civilization. They're absolutely fascinating, man. I love those. I love thinking about it. It's probably my science fiction roots or something, but
yeah, I think something like the whole idea of an asteroid hitting the earth and demolishing us all is a lot more probabilistic than some of these crazy biblical theories that have no basis in reality. So if you like this whole idea of being scared and being sucked into all the drama of these doomsday predictions, then go with science, and you could still get your entertainment, and you could still think critically. It's a win-win.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, guys, so tell our listeners a little bit more about where they can get your books. Are they in both print and ebook and audio format? Are they in all formats? Where do they get them?
Yeah. All my books. I've got 6 books out now. They're available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, online booksellers everywhere, Barnes & Noble physical stores, independent booksellers. Try to support independent bookstores wherever you people live. I love independent bookstores. You know, they're such a beautiful, important thing in the world. We need those bookstores out there. So yeah, my books are there. If they're not there, just tell the people behind the counter and they will order it for you in no time, I'm sure. But yeah, and it's available in Nook, Kindle, ebooks, all that stuff.
All right. And do you have a website, Guy?
Yeah. GuyPHarrison.com. GuyPHarrison.com. I also write a blog for Psychology Today. It's called About Thinking. You can just find it online. Psychology Today, About Thinking. I write essays about all sorts of stuff.
Okay. Well, Guy, it was a pleasure once again speaking with you. I really like having you on here. It's a lot of fun stuff to talk about. Right up my alley.
Yeah, I love being on, Bo. You're great, man. You're an excellent interviewer. Always love being on your show.
All right. Thanks so much.
I'm here with Dr. Jeff Jarman, who is the Associate Director of the Elliott School of Communication at Wichita State University. Thanks for joining us today.
Sure, absolutely.
So your talk today was, is it possible to win a debate? So is it possible?
Well, you know, I gave conflicting answers about that. I think it's important to remember that in a lot of our really controversial topics, a single debate is not likely to produce the kind of change we want it to produce. But that in the long term, after repeated exposure to not just one debate, but all of the information that makes those debates possible, that makes them happen, that people can eventually change their mind. But that's a difficult process, and you know, it's not comfortable. We want debates to be, you say your side, the other side says their side, and then we know who's right and who's wrong. But that's probably not how our brains work, and that's probably not how persuasion works.
Well, and is winning the debate even the goal?
You know, I think that's a great question. I think people, the debaters, want to win. But a part of what I said today was we really need to temper those expectations. That should not really be the goal. On a topic that where there's really strongly held values, it probably makes more sense to focus on a quality presentation and providing the information for people so that when they do want to read about something else, when they do want to learn about the other side of the issue, they know it's there and they have trust in the information that they're about to read. And so the goal of debating should probably be less to win, but should act as a sign to people to acknowledge that there is another side and that they ought to investigate all of the information.
Well, that wouldn't work for me because I always want to win.
Yes, well, of course, that is the hard part because who wants to lose a debate after all?
And I always want to be right.
Yes, well, and you know, I think that mentality makes for great debates. When both sides come prepared, when both sides are making their very best arguments. And I'm the debate coach. I love people making good arguments. The difference is it's so unsatisfying because at the end of those, at the end of these larger societal debates, we're not going to pick a winner and a loser. It takes a much longer time for that to happen.
So you mentioned societal debates. Are you referring to political debates? Are you referring to just social issues?
All of those things, and even more. We're talking whether the topic is which candidate should I vote for, or whether I should believe in a particular public policy or not, whether I should believe that the minimum wage should be raised or not, or whether I believe there's a God or not. Those all invoke very strong value systems that for most people are rather settled. And so those values inform how we hear the debates, how we interpret the debates, what we think about the quality of the evidence, and that makes debating so difficult.
Well, how do you think that we arrive at some of those values? And you talked a little bit about what you called motivational reasoning. Is that part of how we arrive at those values?
Yeah. Actually, for me and the way I approach the topic, people come to these controversies with their values intact. So people have different opinions about religion, about God, about gun control, about whether or not about whether the human condition. I mean, one of the good examples about welfare and the minimum wage involves whether or not you think hard work can actually create, a viable, economically sustainable life. Some people believe if you just work harder, then you'll be successful, and other people believe that the system has some inherent flaws and people need to be helped out. Those, we come to the debates with those, and they're what make deciding debates so difficult because we tend to, motivated reasoning now says, we tend to think that our side's arguments are better than the other side's arguments because our values are influencing our interpretation of the facts.
So we come to a debate already believing one thing and not necessarily being open to changing our mind.
Absolutely. It's why political debates don't work. It's why fact-checking doesn't work. And it's why in debates about religion, mostly people leave with their prior belief intact because we don't abandon those strong commitments as quickly as debating would suggest we should.
So how can learning more about debate, communication, forensics help the average Joe in their everyday life?
To me, and we have some research that confirms this, learning and appreciating the process of debate equips people to more readily set aside their bias for their value system and more readily accept accuracy as how they should resolve a particular controversy. But even in those cases, to be clear, when we've asked people with argumentation training and debate training to look at a statement by a politician, they always initially take their candidate's side. But when they are shown evidence that runs to the contrary to that, they are willing to admit that the other side has made a good point. People without that kind of training are less likely to do that. They're more dismissive of evidence that runs counter to what they believe in.
Sometimes I understand that when people are given facts that counter what they already believe, it oftentimes leads them to dig in their heels.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'm sorry.
No, absolutely. That's one of the real problems that happens. You know, our brains, the way we're wired, as soon as we hear things, within milliseconds, our brain goes working to draw that information out of long-term memory and put it into working memory, which is the dig in the heels effect. The reason we dig in our heels is our brain has just been flooded with all of our opinions, our prior histories, our values, our experiences, and those things are meaningful to people, and they're the kinds of things that then shape and influence what comes after that.
So you talked a little bit about having a goal of accuracy, and you had talked about partisan motivation or accuracy motivation. Can you describe that a little bit and maybe what might be an impetus for someone switching from a partisan goal to an accuracy goal?
Yeah, it is the big challenge really in what we're describing. We'd love it if everyone were always motivated by accuracy, where one side says one thing, the other side says another, and we can just figure out which argument is more likely true and which is more likely false. Unfortunately, that's a real challenge to get people to do that. We are more often in moments that matter to us when we have strongly held values and strong convictions. We're more likely to take the motivational route, the partisan route, rather than the accuracy route.
So we talked a little bit about political debates, and I'm curious if you have any opinions on how political rhetoric has changed over time.
Yeah, you know, to me, what I see is the influence of the mass media and television in particular as playing a really important role in what we get as political information. And so, unfortunately, it seems like sound bites are the more common thing that we'll receive as opposed to an extended explanation of some particular fact. We're more likely to get information about whether a bill will pass or fail, and less likely to get information about whether the bill should pass or should fail. And that's true, I think, not just in the realm of politics, but on all social, political, and cultural issues. We're given information that is strategic in how it's presented as the strategy of one side versus another, because for the media, that's fairness. But the reality is information on all of these topics are more complicated than for or against, and we never get the reasons why something we should be for or against another thing. And so a lot of that is probably being reinforced by broadcast, which makes our attention span so much shorter, which makes the quality of the information even, you know, goes down from there. Those are all a part of a process where our political dialogue is breaking down. And it's, I think, just a sign of the dialogue we have on a whole host of topics. If we can't do it can't have good dialogue on politics, we're not likely to do it on any other issue either, because we're being trained to pick sides, to take sides, and to not hear and listen to what the other side has to say.
Well, and I think you kind of hit on the media trying to be fair, but there's not always an either or. There's not always two sides, and both sides don't necessarily have the same evidence to back them up. Yeah. So they're not equal, and fair may not be mean equal.
Absolutely. And I'm not, I don't intend this to, I mean, I didn't mean for this to just be in the media is the problem. You know, we're a part of the problem as well. We end up watching TV stations that do that. We buy newspapers and magazines that only give us that slant, and so we're as much to blame in this as the media, but it is, I think, a serious problem that that what they do give us, what little we do get, is not enough to equip us to make good decisions. I mean, at the end of the day, you would want even something like the newspaper, if you just read it every day, could you figure out if we should, you know, pass one piece of legislation or the other? But that's not the way reporting works anymore. And so as a society, we're encouraged to make decisions on the basis of less than all of the information. And then that spills over into all of the decisions that we make.
I'm going to switch gears briefly and have you put your debate director hat on.
Yeah.
So I've seen debates occur where one side will be presenting and just throw out dozens of assertions. They just, you know, shoot those off one by one by one by one, and there may not be time to actually address each of those assertions in the rebuttal. What do you say to your students who have this happen, and is there a way to handle that?
And you're talking about in an actual, like,
intercollegiate
or in a high school debate?
Right.
You know, it's important. It's a funny question. It is true. They do that. You know, there is a strategy involved in that. But think about what we've said, what we talked about today, and what we're dealing with in those particular debates. They know, those students who are debating, they know what the judge is likely to do in those moments. That is, they have an understanding of what motivates the judge to decide the debates. And so they've learned that they can do that because the judge will reward that. And so that's really just a product of everything we've talked about today, which is that if you know who you're speaking to and you know what they'll do with the information, give them what they want and let them do that with the information. And that's because debating in high school and debating in college is a lot less about the actual persuasiveness of a given speech, but more about training people to learn how to think about topics and argue about topics. So it's more of a process creating a mentality than it is a particular search for the actual truth of the resolution.
So they don't have to address all of those assertions.
Just lots of judges say they do have to address them. And if they run out of time, that's exactly right. And now you know the strategy. If you know that the judge will reward you, then that's what you do. And if you're debating in front of a judge who won't reward all of those quickly, you know, spoken assertions, then you have to find a different strategy.
So I wrote down knowing your enemy.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about this in regards to debate, of being aware of what they are going to come to the debate table with.
Yes.
Can you address that for me a little bit?
I think it is the central strategic requirement to have a good debate. It's not just what do you want to say, but it's anticipating in advance what your opponents will say and understanding how to undermine that position. It's what takes an awful lot of time in order to get prepared to have a debate, but the alternative is to wing it, and that's no good either. You do need to know exactly as much as you can what your opponents are going to say so that you can be prepared to rebut it. and you need to understand how that information is being heard and interpreted by your side and by their side. And I think this is the problem with political debating on any socio-political issue, on all of them. It's that we are more often than not trying to rebut a claim, but that rebuttal is only effective for our side. It's never framed as an effective argument for the other side, because it never comes to grip with why the other side believes what they believe. And so until we can strategize ways to make those rebuttals relevant to the other side, then you're never going to win. It's a very difficult challenge, but that is actually the challenge.
And can we do that? Can we achieve that?
You know, we can, but think about what I just said. We have to figure out how the other side is wrong and make it meaningful to the other side, not just because it's wrong, but we have to make them understand that it's wrong, believe that it's wrong, and make it so they want to accept that. Because right now, there is evidence on the other side for every one of the points that could be made. Somebody has made the opposite point. What we have to do is make our arguments, frame our arguments, choose our language carefully so that we equip and empower the other side to change their mind, which is a very difficult thing to do.
Well, it's great talking to you today, and I just want to give my thanks to Dr. Jeff Jarman from the Elliott School of Communication at Wichita State University.